I'm Mitch Finley. My wife Kathy and I are here just for this week, and basically the topic that I've chosen for this series of get-togethers is one that's not so much an academic interest of mine as a personal interest. And so as a result, that's led to me spending a little bit more time than the average person probably trying to understand what it's all about and how it can fit into an ordinary person's ordinary everyday life. Not only while one is spending a little bit of downtime here at Holden, but back out there in the busy world that we all inhabit on a regular basis most of the time. So, I want to be very clear about the fact that I'm not talking about all of us trying to live as if we inhabited a monastery or something like that. You know, we all have real lives that we're trying to live, and I think often we ask ourselves, how can we fit a little bit of deeper prayer into our lives and be a little deeper than we're ordinarily used to? And that raises the question, of course, we could spend the whole five sessions probably just defining our terms. But when we hear the word prayer, everybody tends to act as if we all know what that means. We all nod our heads and say, yeah. We all know what that word means. It's like the word God. You know, we all nod our heads, yeah, okay, yeah, we all know what that means. You know, and yet we're talking about the most incomprehensible mystery in our experience. You know, we don't understand it at all, but we act as if we do. So when I say prayer, I think probably one of the most important things I would like you to keep in mind is that we are talking about a tremendous mystery here, because we're talking about our relationship with the divine mystery and attempts on our part to be in relationship with the divine mystery. You know, no matter what kind of prayer we're talking about human efforts to be in relationship with the divine mystery. That raises something that I think is crucial to everything else I'm going to be talking about. And if you happen to have grabbed a Bible, these particular two passages here are very well known to all of us, but they're going to be very basic to everything that I'm going to be saying, so I want to go over these just briefly here. You'll recognize this right away, I'm sure. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah, saying, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He answered, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to take it away." I've always thought that Elijah, you know, if we could read into this, his tone of voice, it's almost as if he's saying, "I'm pretty hot stuff." You know, "I'm pretty hot stuff, Lord, and gosh, they're picking on me." You know, and here I am just trying to do your work. Okay. The Lord said, he said, "Go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by." Now, there was a great wind, so strong that it was splitting mountains and breaking rocks in pieces before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of sheer silence. That's a great translation, sheer silence. And of course, that's where Elijah finally perceives the presence of God. In that sound, if you will, of sheer silence. Contemplative prayer is anything. It's an attempt to allow silence to have an impact on us as persons from deep down inside. It's an attempt to get in touch with that silence in ourselves that is so often covered up by the noise and the activity that fills our lives. And sometimes that can be frightening. You know, one of the most frightening things you can do to the average American is put that person in a room alone, no music, no books, nothing, and say, you have to sit there like that for an hour. You know, we tend to lose it. You know, culturally, we are completely unprepared for an experience of just sitting there and being quiet and allowing the silence to surface within ourselves. We get terrified. You know, even in our homes, once the kids are grown or gone or they're all off to school during the day or whatever, what have we got going? We've got the TV on, even if we're not watching it. We've got a radio on. We've got music coming out of the stereo, whatever it might be. We'll do almost anything to drive the silence away or cover it up so that we don't have to be in touch with it so much. Okay, so in a sense, when we say we're interested in contemplative prayer, we're taking a real big chance here. We're really kind of sticking our necks out and saying, I'm going to do something very un-American. Now, this is very countercultural, what I'm about to do. Okay, the other passage is in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 22. And as soon as I find that, again, this is very familiar to all of us, 22:34. When the Pharisees heard that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together, and one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him. Teacher, which commandment in the law is the greatest? He said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the greatest and first commandment. And a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. This is just an opinion of mine, but I think that we have kind of run away from the first half of that commandment and taken refuge in the second half. You know, if somebody comes up to us and says, tell me about your love for God, or how do you experience God's love? We immediately run to the second half of that commandment and say, oh, well, you know, I experience my love for God and my love for other people. Or I love God by serving other people, by taking care of other people's needs or caring for other people. Well, you can't argue with that kind of theology, obviously. But nevertheless, I believe that we are supposed to love God directly also. I think our lives are empty if we don't have an ongoing love for God, if we're not trying to cultivate our relationship with God, our love for God directly, in addition to finding God in our relationships with other people. Are we up?
I think so.
Okay. So silence, love for God, I think that's what contemplative prayer builds on. Okay, this idea that I, in fact, have something, an empty place inside of me that only God can fill. That we're born with that. And only by trying to love God and allow God to love me. And ordinarily, the only way, you know, the best way of doing that is through some form of prayer. You know, it doesn't mean we're all going to become great mystics, you know, or have fabulous mystical experiences of one kind or another. It simply means that I make some time in my life in a way that's best suited to me to love God and to feel God's love for me in some way. Does that make sense? Okay, I hope so. The title of this whole series is Contemplative Prayer and Healing. I don't want to suggest that I'm going to get into the whole business of physical healing at all. I think that there's plenty that can be said about that. And many of you probably read Larry Dossey's books, Healing Words, I think, was the first one. This is his latest one, Prayer is Good Medicine. He's probably the best known and the best qualified to talk about that whole thing, you know, of the impact of prayer on physical healing. I want to suggest that there's a connection between contemplative prayer and emotional and spiritual healing. Cultural critics have suggested that we live in a therapeutic society today. You know, if we have a problem of some kind, then there is a therapy of some form that is appropriate to that. You know, 12-step groups, whatever it might be, counseling, one-on-one personal counseling, whatever it might be. And whereas Larry Dawson suggests that along with medical care, people should be including in their treatment prayer, you know, for their physical well-being, I'm suggesting that along with involvement in the 12-step group or the counseling we're getting or whatever it might be, that prayer can have a profound impact. Contemplative prayer in particular can have a profound impact on our emotional and spiritual health. You know, that healing can go on there, even apart from involvement in a 12-step group or whatever it might be. I know from personal experience that this is the case. None of us arrives on the threshold of adulthood without some hurt of some kind. Nobody grows up in a perfect family. Anybody here? Raise your hand if you grew up, if you had perfect parents, you know, or perfect siblings. You know, we all have that's great. Okay. you've heard the old phrase, love with a limp, you know. We all have places in ourselves that need to be healed. And I know from personal experience that by spending time in contemplative prayer on a regular daily basis, simply allowing God's love to well up within us has a healing effect, you know, on those places in us that need to be healed. You know, but we have to allow that to happen. We have to make space in our lives for that experience before it's going to happen. Okay. I'm not going to be talking about a lot more about the business of healing. Okay, that's just the point I want to make, and I'll probably mention it again as we go along. But we're going to be practicing this as I talk about it in each of these sessions too. I hope we're going to have a few minutes in each session to practice the particular kind of contemplative prayer that we're talking about in that session for just a few minutes at the end of each of our gatherings. And as a way of hopefully providing, establishing a climate, I thought maybe music would be a good way for us to begin to settle down, begin to feel that spirit of silence and that spirit of healing that we're going to be talking about. So I would urge you to get comfortable, you know, take a deep breath, close your eyes if that's good. If you got room, you can lay on the floor, you know, whatever is good for you, and then just listen to this piece of music. Thank you.
Okay. Everybody wake up.
Somebody has described contemplation as a long, loving look at the real. Whether we're talking about contemplative prayer or contemplative attitude towards a nature walk, I think that fits. A long, loving look at the real. Just exposing yourself. You know, somebody, who was it? The former mayor of Portland. Talked about exposing yourself to art. Anybody ever see that poster? Got him from behind with a raincoat. Exposing himself to art. Anyway, we're talking about paying attention, giving our attention to the ultimate reality. Okay, we're talking about contemplative prayer. The problem is that when it comes to the ultimate reality, the great mystery that we call God, all we have to rely upon are images and metaphors of various kinds. Nobody has seen God directly and lived. You know, as Scripture says. Anybody here seen God directly? Okay, we have to relate by means of images and metaphors. And that's good. Those things are wonderful, but sometimes they can get in the way as much as they facilitate our relationship with God. And so sometimes it's helpful to shake those things up a little bit, you know, rattle our cages a little bit, and point out that even though we love our metaphors for God, they are all of them inadequate to one degree or another. So it can be helpful to play with our metaphors for God. So, with that in mind, I would like to read a little story that I wrote. The bookstore people like it if we recommend the books, so this is The Gospel Truth, Living for Real in an Unreal World, and that I wrote, and it is, it begins with a story that is based on, I call it a theological fantasy. And the purpose of the story is to suggest a metaphor for God by means of the story that's different from the metaphors we usually, that we're most familiar with. The title of the story is A Particular Judgment, a Theological Fantasy. The title, A Particular Judgment, comes from an old, no longer used, at least mostly no longer used, Catholic catechism called the Baltimore Catechism. The edition I quote from was published in 1949. And I begin the story with a question and an answer from this old catechism that goes like this. What is the judgment called which will be passed on each one of us immediately after death? Answer. The judgment which will be passed on each one of us immediately after death is called the particular judgment. The sentence of this judgment is final and will not be reversed. Now, mind you, this is a catechism that was used with children. You know, this was a terrifying thought, you know, to a kid especially. So I decided to play around with it and do something completely the opposite. The story goes like this. An exceptionally large black bird spread its wings, squawked, and flapped reluctantly away from an old stone fence at the highway's edge. Squinting his eyes as they adjusted to daylight after the dim interior of the gray bus, Jacob Wharton stepped off and glanced around as the bus roared away in a dark cloud of diesel exhaust. It felt good to stand and to move his arms and legs. Jacob coughed and waved his hand in front of his face to clear the diesel fumes from his lungs. He massaged the back of his neck with one hand to relieve the stiffness. Jacob hadn't the slightest idea where he was, and for that matter, he had not a clue as to where he had come from. His short-term memory took in a grand sweep of about the last 60 seconds since he had found himself leaving the bus. Oddly, Jacob felt neither anxious nor fearful, only curious. The day was sunny and warm, and the fields on both sides of the two-lane highway were full of wheat that was golden brown. Had anyone been watching, what they would have noticed first was this. Jacob was wearing bright yellow shoes that nearly sparkled. Below his tan windbreaker and rumpled brown slacks, from the ankles down, he looked like a Florida real estate salesman. Otherwise, Jacob would never get a second glance. He was neither old nor young, not tall and not short, and his thinning, curly brown hair was neatly trimmed. He wore no hat, and he carried no luggage. Jacob coughed again and then inhaled a deep breath of clean country air. He closed his eyes and took pleasure from the smell of wildflowers, trees, and damp earth. As Jacob began to walk down a narrow dirt road that led away from the highway, a gentle breeze came up and it felt to Jacob like a comfort. He removed his jacket and slung it over his shoulder as he walked. In the distance, at the end of the road, under a stand of venerable locust trees, Jacob could see an old man down on his hands and knees in faded bib overalls, hammering nails into the boards of a porch that was long and wide. The white two-story farmhouse to which the porch was attached looked well kept and so much a part of the landscape that it could have been there forever. The old man, with perspiration slipping down his cheeks and into his short gray beard, looked up as Jacob approached. "Good to see you, Jacob Wharton," he called. "Good to see you indeed." He smiled broadly as he sat back on his heels and wiped his face with a blue bandana. How could this old man know his name? The question occurred to Jacob, but he was not bothered by it, did not even feel like asking it. "Thanks," he said as he approached the house. Jacob climbed four new, yet-to-be-painted wooden steps to the porch and stepped carefully over a pile of shining nails. "Tell the truth," he said, "I'm not sure where I am. Could you?" "Best you talk to the woman of the house," said the old man, holding up his hammer to interrupt. "Oh, okay, sure." The wooden screen door rattled as Jacob knocked a polite three times. "She's busy upstairs," the old man added as he began to drive another nail. "Go ahead and let yourself in." Inside the old-fashioned house, Jacob felt as if he had stepped into the warm and welcoming home his grandparents lived in when he was a boy. It had a soft, lived-in feel to it, as if its natural purpose was to comfort the weary. Off to the left in the parlor, a roll of paper with neat little long and short vertical holes punched in it turned slowly, and an old upright player piano began to play. "In the good old summertime, in the good old summertime, you'll be my Tootsie Wootsie in the good old summertime." Jacob stood still and listened, remembering the words, smiling, slowly tapping his right foot in time to the music. "Welcome, Jacob, welcome. You're a sight for sore eyes and then some." Jacob glanced up, and on the stairs, hurrying down in a long blue and white gingham dress, was a woman delightful to look at. Jacob felt a deep, warm attraction for her on sight. The woman wore no makeup. She was not beautiful in the manner cultivated by women who try to imitate magazine cover girls. She could afford to lose 5 pounds, but her beauty was natural and radiant, perfectly unselfconscious. Jacob smiled. He thought briefly of the girl he fell in love with in high school. The woman gathered Jacob into her arms, and in her warm embrace, he felt like he had been lost and found, as if he had always been her beloved and always would. "Here," she said, stepping away from him, her hands on his shoulders, "let me take a look at you." She was slightly taller than Jacob, and her smile was full of undisguised affection. Framed by thick, shining auburn hair, her face glowed softly with a light of its own. Jacob scratched his chin and grinned like a schoolboy. "You look fine," said the woman, "really fine. Toss your jacket on a chair and come on upstairs." As he followed the woman up the deeply carpeted staircase, Jacob wondered what was going on. He was mystified by the genuine joy his arrival had inspired. "Make yourself comfortable, Jacob." "Thank you," he said. But with a sudden cold flash of anxiety, he began to wonder if he should break and run or ride this thing out to the end. Probably better to keep calm. After all, there would be no sense in making a fool of himself. Off to the left, in the large room they had entered, two soft old Morris chairs faced each other at an angle. On a dark little table between the chairs, in a slim white vase, was a single red rosebud just beginning to open. Jacob and the woman sat down. The floor was light polished hardwood, and the walls were freshly painted white. Two big windows, raised open a few inches, made the room airy and bright. Thin white curtains lifted gently with the breeze, as in an Andrew Wyeth painting. In the far corner sat a big, sturdy old four-poster bed with a billowing light blue canopy. A colorful patchwork quilt and fresh white sheets were turned down, revealing hugely plump pillows. A steaming hot meal was spread on a round oak table in the middle of the room. The smell of hot cornbread and baked ham was unmistakable. The white linen tablecloth was immaculate. "That sure smells good," Jacob said, smiling. He crossed his legs so that the bright yellow shoe on his right foot bobbed forward a little, back a little, forward a little, back a little. "Do you like your new shoes?" the woman asked. Her breasts, as she leaned slightly forward in her chair toward Jacob, were wonderful, heavenly, swelling warmly above the top of her modestly low-cut dress. "What?" "Oh," Jacob replied, "yes. I only noticed I had these shoes when I got off the bus out there. They make me feel different. Somehow they fit. They make me want to do a little dance." Jacob stood up and walked, almost skipped, over to the window and back. Then he sat down again. "They make me feel like a new man." "They're really you, Jacob." As he looked into the woman's deep brown eyes, Jacob thought his heart might burst with sweet, sweet love. "How about something to eat?" she said. "I cooked it myself." "Thank you," Joseph replied. "I am hungry. That ham and cornbread sure looks good." Jacob and the woman sat at the table in plain wooden farmhouse chairs. "Some of everything," she said, and she helped Jacob to huge portions of ham, cornbread, and hot buttered peas. From a blue porcelain pitcher, she poured a tall glass of iced lemonade. "Tell me how things are for you, Jacob." She sliced a square of hot cornbread in two and spread butter on both pieces. Then she began to eat, smiling at Jacob, politely dabbing with the tip of her little finger at the corners of her mouth. Jacob's hand paused in midair, balancing a fork full of peas as he looked into the woman's glowing face. He felt a desire so sweet and so good that his heart ached. Deep inside, Jacob wanted to tell this woman his life story and leave nothing out. At the same time, he felt fearful of saying anything at all. "Oh, my life is ordinary," he said casually, intending to keep the conversation superficial. But his voice began to work as if his mind and will had been gently short-circuited. He spoke from his heart, giving a compact summary of his life with the non-essentials trimmed away. "I have believed far more than I should have and far less than was good for me. I broke a promise once, a big one. I've been afraid of so much. And most of the time, as it turned out, there was no need to be so. Sometimes I feel so lonely. I was married, but something happened. I still think about her. I have a son and a daughter, and I love them more right now than I ever loved them before. I work long hours in an office. I don't enjoy life much, and I drink more than I should. But the thing is, and I've never thought about this before, I can never get enough of anything. Lately, whether I'm alone or working or with other people, I feel empty. It's like..." Jacob tried to swallow away the lump in his throat. "Sorry, I didn't mean to go on like that. I don't know. I haven't got much of a story. I feel so melancholy. What a life." He took a deep breath to try to keep the tears back, shrugged his shoulders apologetically, and looked up from the plate of hot food he had been staring into as he talked. "Jacob," the woman said quietly, as if telling him a wonderful secret, "all shall be well. Have you forgotten my love for you? My love is deep, Jacob Wharton, my love." She left her chair, walked around the table to where Jacob sat, and drew him up gently by his hands so that he stood facing her, looking into her eyes. Jacob's lips parted in surprise, and salty tears rolled down to the corners of his mouth. "I don't understand," he said. "I..." "Remember, Jacob, remember." Then Jacob's forgetting began to fade, and dark memories, cold and terrifying, came slowly as out of a distant darkness. The screech of tires on asphalt as he stepped off the curb in the sunshine. The second that his head swam dark with pain. Then nothing at all until he was getting off the gray bus. Wait, where am I? Jacob trembled. His open hands went to his face, which had gone pale, and his eyes were wide with fear. What is this place? How did I get here? Now there were tears in the woman's eyes, too. She pressed Jacob's trembling right hand to her heart and looked into his eyes. Her voice was soft and steady, full of gentle compassion. Oh, Jacob, my love for you and my desire for you is endless, absolutely endless. Oh, Jacob said vacantly. But as the woman drew him into her embrace for the second time and stroked the back of his head, Jacob's fear slipped away. She held Jacob in her arms and comforted him, rocking gently from side to side. Here, the woman said softly. Then, as Jacob stood back a step, she reached behind her with both hands to unbutton the back of her dress. She slipped her arms out through the sleeves and let the top drop away. Then she lifted Jacob's hands and placed them on her breasts. He was filled with a love for her that was at the same time passionate and pure. Oh, my God, Jacob whispered. That's right, the woman said, and I have wanted you since before the world began. Then she walked Jacob Horton to the big, sturdy old four-poster bed with the billowing light blue canopy, where the patchwork quilt and fresh white sheets were turned down. Well, I hope that shook up some people's metaphors for God. There's nothing in the story that you won't find in the Bible, just in case anybody's upset. What does that leave you with? Trying to be as objective as possible. In terms of your own understanding of God and your feelings for God. Obviously, this theological fantasy is a male theological fantasy. But all the same, what does it do? Does it feel at all to you like maybe you feel a little bit more able to play around with your own metaphors for God? You know, that's mine. May not work for you, you know, but as long as we're talking about metaphors, what does it do? Anything for anybody? What kind of response did you have on just on a feeling level, let's say?
Mm-hmm. I've been trying this for a number of years, and I just have been trying to center on something. And I had a dream once about walking. There was a big place with a green hedge around it, and it was mountains, and there was one gate that pushed back and forth. And I walked in, and there were sheep all around. And this is a dream, but I use it a lot. And up on a hill, I thought I saw someone. And I run up closer, and then I saw it was Jesus. And I ran up there, and I sat next to him on the, and I just poured out all my problems and everything. But now, as I go on, I see that same thing when I closed my window. I was listening to the music, but when I got up there, I was quiet, but I could just feel his arms around me, and I could just feel my love for him and for me.
Okay. Anybody else? Did the story do anything in particular for anybody?
I just have a hard time looking at God from a sensualistic point of view.
Okay.
And I know that there's that kind of passion, but I hadn't looked at God from a female side, that he would fulfill those longings or those desires. So that was kind of interesting. I mean, I think my first reaction was like, excuse me?
Yeah.
But where is this going? Yeah. What does this really have to do with contemplative prayer? But I can see where maybe coming in touch with those kind of feelings can, you know, realize that that is how God looks at us and says, yes, I want you.
Yeah.
And all of you for, you know, wherever you're at.
Yeah. For centuries, the Song of Songs in the Old Testament has been used, you know, as a way of describing our relationship with God and God's feelings for us. You know, and it's erotic from beginning to end, the whole thing. If you haven't read it lately, I suggest you do so. We're talking divine revelation here. You know, divinely inspired book of the Bible. And there it is. So why can't we do the same kind of thing? You know, there are authors who have talked about God's love for us as being comparable to the love to two lovers, you know, feelings for each other. Okay? You know, why not? Unless human erotic feelings are bad or evil in themselves, which I don't think we can say if God created this, you know, in us. We can't say that. Then anything in our experience can be used as a way of understanding God. Just as you look at a painting of an artist, by an artist, you look at Van Gogh's Starry, Starry Night, you learn something about Van Gogh.
Okay? Part of the difficulty with this sensual picture, though, is that for 1,500 years we have told ourselves the body, the material, the sensual, is not spiritual.
Yeah, it's inherently risky.
It's a whole retraining
of
spirituality.
Absolutely.
To permit that picture.
Sure, you bet. I couldn't agree more. Yeah. But, got to start somewhere. So, anyway, what's our time like here? I do want to move on a little bit here and talk about... I guess maybe part of your homework then is, you know, thinking through that. You know, what is there in your experience that, you know, or your understanding of life and the world, is there anything that you're inherently uncomfortable with, or that you are particularly comfortable with? Okay, what are ways that you can use those as ways of relating to God? You know, I don't think any of us have a problem with relating to God through nature that we find around us, especially in a place like this. And that's great. Maybe that can be the foundation for your own practice of contemplative prayer in some way or another. Okay. This part of what I want to talk about here comes under this section right here, the mechanics of contemplative prayer. Okay, it's just like we have... You know, we have these practical questions that we try to that we need to answer if we're going to make room in our daily lives for some contemplative experience of some sort that's prayerful in nature. And just quickly, I'll go over these. First of all, there's the issue of time and place. That's a big one for us in our culture, especially. Where am I going to find time to spend a little bit of time in contemplative prayer in my ordinary everyday life? Okay? It isn't as difficult as most of us think it is, or as difficult as we tell ourselves that it is. You know, it's a matter of what do we value? Okay? What are our priorities? We find time to eat. We may find time to exercise. We find time to work. We get our work done. Spend all those hours on the job. I dare say we probably find time to watch television a little bit every day, probably. We find time to read a book. Here you don't watch television, obviously. But, okay, we make time for the things that are important to us. That's what it boils down to. You know, we keep saying, I wish I could find the time to do this, that, or the other thing. You know, time is not something we find. You know, you're not walking along one day and you say, whoa, I found 5 minutes laying on the ground here, you know, like you found a dime or something. It doesn't work that way. We make time for the things that we value most, the things that are important to us. So it's a matter of making time. As I'll be saying, talking a little bit more in a minute here, we're not talking about a lot of time, however. Okay? Time and place. It's good to have a place where you can have some quiet. You know, some quiet of some sort. There are people who find just maybe 5 or 10 minutes during their lunch hour, during their work day, when they can be someplace where it's relatively quiet. There are people who, you know, are working out of their homes, for example. More and more people have home offices. So it's not that difficult if they make up their minds to do that, to find the place. The length of time, I think starting out with 10 minutes is a good goal for anybody. 10 minutes of just being still. Sitting down, letting God take care of it all. You know, trying to give up all the anxiety and the worry and all that stuff that we struggle with all day long, the hassles, the feelings that we have, and just saying, okay, I'm going to make this 10 minutes be a time during which I am simply going to be open and aware of God's presence in me and in the world around me. Frequency, once a day, is a good place to start. A goal, ultimately, long range, can be maybe 10 minutes twice a day, 10 minutes three times a day. A lot of people will go from that kind of an approach to ultimately saying, okay, I'm going to put my 3 10-minute periods and I'm going to practice contemplative prayer for 1.5 hours straight. Okay, you have not even begun to understand how long a half an hour is. Until you do this, okay? Yes.
Well, the first time I tried it was here at Golden Village, and I went in. I was up in a hotel, and I was all alone. And so I went into a room that hadn't been rented, and so then I sat there and got real comfortable. And then I thought about a Bible verse, and I kind of hummed a hymn and got real quiet, and I sat there, and I sat there, and things kept coming in and out, and I'd say that verse over again, and I thought, oh, I just sat here for 15 minutes anyway, and I looked at my watch, and 4 minutes had gone by.
It was just unreal.
Yeah,
doing this for 10 minutes may not sound like much, but as we'll see as we go along here during the course of the week, one of the things about contemplative prayer is that it's habit forming. You develop a thirst for it after a while, so you wouldn't dare miss it. Okay, so it's easy to get discouraged at the beginning, but I encourage people to not allow discouragement to win. Okay, posture can be a big thing. You know, we've all seen the pictures of people who practice Zen or you know, sit in the lotus position and all this kind of stuff. We Westerners, as a general rule, don't find that very successful, you know, when we try to do that kind of stuff. So I encourage people to just sit in a chair very much like the ones we've got in here. Sit up straight, relax, close your eyes, breathe evenly, this kind of thing. Okay, it's not... some people find, you know, that they when they get into standing on their head, you know, or lying down on the floor, but then they go to sleep. You know, you don't want to do that. Although there are some, you know, great mystics down through the centuries who said the prayer of sleep is one of the highest forms of prayer because you're trusting in God to the point where you're willing to go to sleep and let God handle it. You know, so I don't want to badmouth sleep either. Breathing, the breathing process is one that's just very natural, simply breathing in and out very normally, naturally, not concentrating on your breathing. There are meditation techniques that involve focusing on your breathing, but we're not going to get into that. I say forget your breathing, just let it happen, just don't stop. Okay. The attitude going into contemplative prayer is one of receiving, of being passive and yet alert at the same time. Openness, receptivity, passivity, but alert. Okay, you can be open and receptive and passive to the point where you fall asleep. So alert is an important part there to maintain the alertness. Okay. Interruptions invariably happen. Okay, the things that the distractions that come into our minds, this kind of thing. The classic advice on this whole thing has been, with your eyes closed, it's almost as if, you know, the distraction comes in your mind, you watch it go by like a fish in an aquarium. You don't zero in on it. You don't say, get out of here! you don't get all upset about it. You just kind of let it be there, let it happen, and then let it disappear again. The same thing if you develop an itch. You know, all of a sudden you got this really bad itch right here, you know. And you just really want to reach down there and scratch. During your contemplative prayer time, the itch is like a distraction. Okay? Because if you are constantly scratching the itches, you're never going to get anywhere. Okay? And it will go away without being scratched. Okay? Unless it's a mosquito bite. And then calamine lotion before meditation would be good. Okay, now, I would like at this point to lead us just briefly, we don't have a lot of time left, but I'd like to lead us briefly through what I call a grounding exercise to do all the things we've been talking about here in the last minute or two. This will be our beginning point from now on in everything that we do, in each exercise that we have. Okay, so, I invite you at this time to, we've taken care of time and place. Length is going to be very brief. We're just going to do this once for now. Posture, sit up straight in your chair. Feet together on the floor. Hands in a receptive, mode of some sort, maybe open in your lap like this. Something, if you try to allow around the arms of your chair, whatever feels good for you, try to make your physical posture one of receptivity, in other words, and of openness, okay? Attitude, receptive, passive, but alert. Don't pay any mind to the distractions, okay? Okay, eyes closed. Notice anything now that you may think could become a distraction. Just know that it's there. Don't give it a lot of attention. Feel comfortable. Adjust your position a little bit if you feel like you need to. Now focus on the sensations in your face and head. Don't try to change the sensations that you find. Just focus on them, be aware that they are there. If you have a pain in your face, just let it be. Just be aware of the sensations in your face and your head in general. Now notice the sensations specifically on the skin of your face. What are you feeling there? Where do you feel warm? Where do you feel cool? Just be aware of those. Be aware of the sensations in the muscles under your skin. The broad muscles of your forehead. Be aware of what you're feeling there. Be aware of the muscle groups around your eyes. Be aware of what you may find there, tension, feelings of whatever sort. Be aware of the powerful muscles of your jaws. Be aware of any tension you might feel there in those muscles. Be aware of the bony structures beneath your facial muscles. be aware of the neck and shoulders, the muscles in your neck and shoulders. Are they tense? Are they tight? Don't try to force yourself to relax. Just be aware of what you're feeling in your neck and shoulders. Be aware of what you're feeling in your elbows. Be aware of the sensations in your wrists and the palms of your hands. Be aware of your hips and pelvic region, tension, whatever you may feel there. Be aware of your knees, sensations in your knees. Be aware of your ankles and the soles of your feet. Now be aware of the region of your heart. Imagine that you are very small, very small. And imagine that you're walking inside of yourself there in the region of your heart. Go deeply into that vast inner space in the center of yourself. Let yourself rest in this place. No need to do anything, simply rest. This is the place for contemplative prayer. When you're ready, let your attention come back to this place where we are. Let feeling return to your feet and hands, your face. Breathe deeply and open your eyes again. Okay, the purpose of this exercise, we kind of did it very step by step, slowly, and that's kind of how we have to do it as beginners. But before very long, you find yourself just doing this very kind of naturally, very relaxed fashion, and there's no need to go through it just kind of step by step like that. And the purpose of it all is to get to our heart center, the center of our being, which is where contemplative prayer will go on. And we'll be talking more about what happens after we've gotten to that point in our subsequent meetings. Are there any questions or
will you use the phrase centering prayer as a synonym for contemplative prayer?
Well, there are different kinds. We're going to be talking about centering prayer. We're going to be talking about the Jesus prayer. Okay. We're going to be talking about what's called Lectio Divina, or prayerful reading, meditative reading. So, and these can all be used, you know, depending on what
the kind of centering prayer would be, a style of,
right,
a form of
right. Yeah.
Thank you.
In order to keep the Bookstar people on my side, I want to be sure I do what they told me to. So, besides the Gospel Truth, which I read the story from before, which, by the way, most of the book is reflections on various sayings of Jesus from the Gospels. This book is 101 Ways to Nourish Your Soul. A subtitle for this might be Cultivating a Contemplative Lifestyle, or cultivating a way of life that is conducive to contemplative prayer. It's basically 101 very short essays on ways to take care of yourself from the inside out. And this book has been selling like hotcakes. So I guess people are finding it helpful, worthwhile. I had him buy a few copies of Finding God, a Handbook of Christian Meditation by Ken Kesh. If you really are interested in going into this in depth, this is a great place to start. He goes into every form of prayer known to the human race, you know, in detail here. So it's a great place, a resource, if nothing else, to have if you're interested in. Finding God. Okay, this one's kind of expensive, $19.95. This one's $13.95, and the other one is $7.95. Thank you all for being here, and I hope we'll see you again tomorrow.